I'm here at the School of Population and Global Health at the University of Melbourne talking to an absolute legend of the drug and alcohol sector, Professor Margaret Hamilton. Professor, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Now, you've co-authored an editorial for us on the so-called ICE epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen the headlines. Is it that bad?
Yes and no.
Yeah?
The no is that I think one of the difficulties of the headlines is they're alarmist, they shock people, and we have professionals, including medical professionals, who rely more on the general media than on their own media sometimes.
Yeah.
And even if they don't rely on it, it still permeates their thinking.
Yeah.
So I think it's not nearly as scary or requiring such dramatic responses, nor does it need or have to have entirely new or things that anyone who is already qualified to deal with general care doesn't know about.
Because methamphetamine's been around for a long time.
It has. I mean, the amphetamine type substances, which are known generally or generically as ATS, because there are many of them that are in that category, amphetamine has been around for a very long time. So that we're familiar with aspects of this substance, what it can do and what to do about it. It's also been used, amphetamines have been used in Australia over many decades. When I first started in this field, which is a long time ago, in the 70s, it was being used then by mainly long-haul truck drivers, students, people who had a reason to try and stay alert and awake. And that's what it was used for. It was seen as a problem, but not as a serious problem of dependency. So the extent to which it is, the answer is yes, is this a big problem? The complexity is that the nature of the amphetamine that's now available, which is crystal methamphetamine, is readily available. Its purity is quite high at the moment in Australia and has been for a few years. And it's smokable, which makes it seem less serious, less risky, less harmful and dangerous.
And more accessible.
And more accessible.
Yeah.
It can also, and is injected by some. So we do think we've got more people who are regular users, and as a result of that purity and the price being relatively low for a dose, we think we've also got more dependent users than we've had for a long time.
What are the ways in which ICE users come into contact with the healthcare sector?
They appear either through accident and emergency, where they are reputed to cause a lot of trouble, and sometimes their behaviour can be very difficult to manage. But they also come in contact with GPs, and they come in contact often coincidentally through other routes. So some ICE users would be seeking antenatal care, for example. Others would be seeking psychiatric care or mental health assistance. So they may just present with physical problems with no mention or apparent explanation that might be related to their methamphetamine use.
So is it a question GPs should ask?
I think GPs generally should assess a person's presentation, and I personally think that GPs should ask about substance use. That should include tobacco use, it should include alcohol use, and they should ask, and what about any other things? In a non-judgmental and respectful manner, as they have learnt to ask about other activities, such as sexual activity, just as a way of screening and checking that this is not an issue.
I've done a few stories in the last few weeks on various issues, including FASD and chlamydia, and one of the common themes seems to be that, that people don't have a regular GP, and so when they wander into a medical centre, it's hard for a GP to start asking those questions when they're just going to see them the once or whatever.
Yeah.
So is that an issue in this case as well?
I think it probably is, because we know that all drug users are somewhat furtive, and so they will avoid, you know, seeing someone who already knows quite a lot about them. That's not always true, and sometimes these people are presented by family members, in a sense, bringing them or dragging them, or family members seeking help and not being able to get the actual user of the substance to the doctor. I think that I would encourage all GPs to ask all patients the basic screening questions about substance use, whether it's a first time and a once only, or whether it's somebody that they've seen before. I just think there are still a lot of things that GPs can do to minimise and reduce smoking. And we know that probably one of the most potent interventions for a smoker is to have a doctor talk to them about their smoking.
Yeah.
And given the close correlation, if you like, between smoking of nicotine cigarettes and the ease with which someone then can smoke crystal methamphetamine, I think it's that transition is a way of entering that conversation.
Okay. We've already got drug and alcohol specialists. Isn't that enough?
No. We don't have enough of them.
Yep.
We have some good news in that the federal government have made a decision to allow the addictions, the qualified addictions medical specialists, a Medicare number for a specialist consultation. That's pretty critical in the scheme of things. But there are very, very small numbers of such people. And the other issue is that many of these people who present do not necessarily want, nor will they necessarily accept a referral to a specialist. I think the main message of our editorial is to suggest that this is not something that is someone else's problem. This is not something that you should say, I don't know what to do, I have no skills, I have no knowledge. What we encourage is that all medical professionals and other allied health professionals and anyone else involved use their usual skills and their usual knowledge of responding to a person who they're concerned about and concerned for. And they do an assessment and they ask the right questions and they offer assistance. There's no magic bullet for this, and it's no different. So it is very, very helpful to have the addiction specialists, but there are not enough of them for this to be managed by them.
Yeah.
They should really be seen as sort of secondary consultants to provide support and assistance for units that are seeing people presenting into accident and emergency, into general practice and any other primary healthcare settings.
What's the rate of relapse like for ICE addicts?
It's very high. So in responding to people who have become particularly those dependent on crystal methamphetamine, what we know is that the withdrawal is more prolonged than the withdrawal, say, from alcohol or from the opiates, from heroin in particular. So it will take a lot longer. So it will, the withdrawal effects will start a little later than for alcohol and for heroin, and will peak within the following few days, so the first 2 weeks really, but they will trail and there'll be a trailing withdrawal phenomenon for quite a long time, a number of weeks. So it's quite difficult often for carers, medical professionals or specialist treatment services to actually hang on to them and follow them through that period. And the other thing is it's so easy to pick up and smoke something. So relapse rates are very high. Having said that, it's worth remembering one of the people who does a lot of work in this area, Dr. Nicole Lee. She says ICE is easier to get off than to stay off. So we know relapse is a major issue.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of effort to hang in there with someone and to repeat treatments and repeat withdrawal. But it is critical to do that. It also means that we need to be tuned in to the importance of relapse prevention. It's a very active, assertive follow-up, constant monitoring, you know, encouraging to come back, warning people about the relapse potential, and just hanging in there.
How important is it to have a multidisciplinary, coordinated system for this? Because we've got funding coming from 17 billion different places.
Very important, makes a big difference. We know a number of these folk have difficulty with their mental health.
Yep.
So having assistance from those who can help to manage the anxiety, often they would experience acute anxiety attacks from time to time, as well as other mental health problems, sometimes co-occurring. Which came first becomes almost irrelevant, but mental health and the use of these and other substances often go hand in hand. It's also very important sometimes to really give these people a very thorough medical check. It's amazing that they often have quite significant physical problems, which if a doctor doesn't think to do the usual standard checks, doesn't pick up on. And so they're seen as, well, this is an ice addict, get them out of here as quickly as possible. Who can I refer them to? What can I do? But it's important to actually check them physically, because sometimes they do have significant physical illness, and some of it's coincidental, and that can be a motivator for ceasing or changing their drug using patterns. So the use of psychologists, of social workers, nurses, mental health personnel, and probably those involved in the sort of social needs, homelessness, you know, having a proper routine in life, whether it's around education or work or any other activity, all of those things we know can make a big difference to reducing relapse rates.
What's the story in the Indigenous community? Are there different needs there?
Well, it's not good. One of the very unfortunate things is that we're seeing higher rates of uptake and more dependency in Indigenous communities than we are in non-Indigenous Australians. And that applies to rural and remote areas as well, sadly. We are seeing this as an epidemic almost in these sorts of communities. It's quite a serious issue in those communities.
You mentioned in the editorial the West Australian model. Tell us a little bit about that and what the benefits there are in that.
That's really about funding. One of the things that the National ICE Task Force have recommended, and which many of us have been calling for some time, is to sort out the funding arrangements for drug treatment and responding to people who are drug dependent in particular. At the moment, this is shared between the Commonwealth and the states, and it's happen chance and a bit topsy-turvy about who gets what funding. Different criteria have been used, and it makes it very hard for either the state or the Commonwealth to plan any sort of sensible, evidence-based, reasonable allocation of resources. So there's been a strong call for sorting that out. There have been studies done, we understand, though the results are not readily available, of how one might go about that in terms of the population needs, including the patterns of drug use among separate geographic locations, and the sort of capacity that is needed, and then what sorts of services make sense for the different drug profiles, such that you could do a modelling or a formulaic, if you like, way of funding services that would be more attuned to what the local community is likely to require. We don't really have that at the moment. Western Australia has had a bit of a go at it. So this isn't crystal methamphetamine specific. It's all the drug treatment. And they are starting to try and use a sort of systematic way of working out where they put their funding. I think generally we would call for that to be made nationwide and for the Commonwealth and states to sort this one out.
So if you were queen for a day, what would be the first thing you'd do?
I'd probably do that. And then I would probably supplement some training, which I would see more as confidence boosting.
Right.
For GPs? For frontline workers, including GPs and primary health care and welfare personnel.
Is there a bit of a fear at the moment?
Well, I think there is. And I think it's that attitude that comes from those alarmist headlines that people feel, well, I don't know enough about this. But there's no special tricks with this group. The important thing is to use your usual, albeit difficult, ways of engaging a patient or a consumer, a person who comes to you, and to try and engage them in a conversation. And during that, do an assessment. Do a screening assessment, and then if you can, do a physical assessment, do a mental health check, and follow through. The approaches are much the same. The specialist treatments, we still think that the most successful treatment in the specialist arena is cognitive behavioural therapy. And that obviously can be done by a trained psychologist. There are also some GPs who are very good at doing that and have been trained, and others, social workers, counsellors and so on. So I think the sort of main message is the training would be to actually remind people they have the knowledge, they have the skills, they need to get over the fear and anxiety and have a go at applying the knowledge and skills that we already do have.
And stop watching 60 Minutes.
And stop watching 60 Minutes. Although I think it's useful sometimes because you're often dealing with families who are responding to that media, and they also are managing sometimes difficult behaviours.
Yep.
So I'm not understating that, or I'm not ignoring the fact that these people, particularly when they are intoxicated on ice or crystal meth, can be difficult to manage. And so can somebody who is having an acute anxiety attack or somebody who is extremely angry. And if you mix all those things up together, then, you know, you do have a kind of recipe for hell. But I think there are ways of managing that, and tuning up our skills in managing aggressive behaviour, managing difficult behaviour. We know that there are ways of doing that. Sometimes the natural response to those behaviours enhances the trouble. So the importance of talking down, coming under the emotion, just talking calmly, quietly, smoothly, reminding people where they are and what's happening to them, so that if a person's hallucinating or something, you're just saying, well, actually, we're in a room and this is what we're doing, and you've come in here and you're welcome to stay for a while. You know, the tone of your voice and the way you do it can make a big difference. Yeah. But if you start yelling at them, they will yell back.
Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.